a mind escape. Are you ready?
Are you ready to escape your mind?
All right, folks, welcome back to Mike and Maurice's Mind Escape. We have an excellent treat for you today. This is episode 307. We are joined by a friend of the show, Laird Scranton. Laird, if you are not familiar with his work, is now the author of 14 books, including the latest one that we are going to discuss, The Waters of Life. I have the link to all of his books down below at the bottom if you want to click on that and check his stuff out. We've talked about a lot of them. Point of Origin, Scarabray, The Mystery of Scarabray, you name it. I mean, I think we've had him on close to 10 times. I don't know if we've had exactly 10 or 8 or 9 or what, but if you're interested, go check out those episodes. I'll try and add a list of them to the show notes after we're done. But yeah, you can find them all on our YouTube channel or anywhere our podcast is found. But yeah, so this is going to be an excellent treat here. If you would like to support Mind Escape, the best way to do that is to click the Linktree link down below and check out all of our stuff. We have a Patreon page, and we actually have probably 4 or 5 segments with Laird on our Patreon as well, if you're interested in that. Yeah, he's also in our documentary, As Within, So Without, From UFOs to DMT, which is free on our YouTube channel. The link for that is also below. But without further ado, welcome back on. How are you, Laird?
Well, I'm terrific. Thank you very much for having me back on. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Yeah, no, it's always a fun and interesting conversation. And, you know, we discuss symbolism and ancient cultures a lot on the show. And I think that there's nobody that goes deeper than you into connecting symbols and linguistics and etymology and things like that. So, your newest book that came out probably right after we had you on last time is called The Waters of Life.
Right.
Why don't you give us a little bit of kind of what The Waters of Life is about and how it connects to your other previous books?
Okay, well, for people who don't know, my field of study is I study symbols and myths and rituals of ancient cultures. I do comparative studies. The field is called comparative cosmology because these esoteric systems are talking about processes of creation. And my entry point into the research is a modern-day African tribe called the Dogon, who are from Mali, which is in the northwest hump of Africa. And this modern tribe, their culture is a kind of umbrella over a number of ancient traditions. They have things in common with ancient Egypt, with Hinduism, with Buddhism, with Judaism, and, of course, all of the related African traditions. They also have things in common with ancient China, with the Maori in New Zealand, and many other cultures around the world. So when the Dogon talk about concepts of creation, they see their societal mission to be one of preserving original forms of symbolic elements, that they're trying to preserve the original forms of ancient words and of ancient symbols and ancient concepts. And then they instruct initiates in this knowledge, sort of one-on-one instruction, sort of like apprenticeship was back in the day. One initiate works with one informant, and it's the initiate's job to ask the next pertinent question for their own education, basically. And the Dogon, when they talk about creation, they're really discussing four different aspects of that, four different themes. The first is how matter forms. The second is how the universe forms. Another is how biological life comes about. And the third one is how consciousness comes about. So until the book, The Waters of Life, most of my focus had been on concepts that relate to the formation of matter. Because that's the theme that has the most recognizable state, the great largest number of recognizable stages and shapes. The Buddhist and the Dogen systems are based on what the Buddhists called adequate symbols. These are shapes that are found in nature that any society like ours that is technologically based should recognize what the shape is, and so the meaning of that shape can't really get lost. These are scientific meanings that go with the shapes. So the Dogen are a particularly good place to start a study like mine because their language has many things in common with ancient Egypt. Actually, their language is technically not classifiable because it preserves subgroupings of words from 18 other languages. There are Turkish words, there are Tamil words, there are Sanskrit words. There are words that look like they come from the Faroese language or the British Isles. There are words that align with ancient Greek words. So my task or my job, as I see it, is when one of these ancient cultures makes a claim about one of the symbolic elements, my job is to test that claim against how all the other ancient cultures saw the same element, because many of them preserve the same shapes. Remember, Carl Jung, the psychiatrist, referred to these themes and shapes as archetypes. He was astounded to find them in cultures all around the world. The Dogen perspective is in agreement with the Buddhist perspective, that they both see things, they see this system of symbols as an instructed tradition, that in ancient times, someone who thoroughly understood how creational science works took the time to set up a system to educate humanity about that. And they made an effort to educate tribal groups all around the world in these concepts. And so that's why you have ancient cultures from all around the world who share really obscure little ideas, like the idea that there's a wheel associated with the constellation of Orion. You look up there, there's no wheel, there's no chariot associated with Orion, but any number of ancient cultures said there was.
Yeah, so do you think it's something that, given enough time or maybe time and space, that most ancient cultures came up with similar things, hence the commonalities? Or do you think it's one society or culture coming up with these ideas and then it spreading out? I know that your books have kind of a little bit of both of those.
Right. Well, academics have a concept called parallel development. And parallel development is, okay, imagine you have a culture that whose primary building material is stone. It's only a matter of time. There are only so many things you can do with stone. It's only a matter of time before they'll think to stack those stones up into a pyramid shape. So it's completely thinkable that lots of different cultures would think to build pyramids because that's one of the things you can do with stone. However, there's also very subtle symbolism that consistently goes with that pyramid form that all these cultures somehow know about, even though it's not wouldn't be automatic to conceptualize a pyramid as a woman lying on her back and the pyramid being her womb. It wouldn't be expected that a culture would use the four faces of a pyramid to associate with star groups that regulate their agricultural cycle. So it's the symbolism that makes it look as if this is a system, a planned system, and an instructed system, not just coincidental development by different cultures. So the common outlook is that in ancient times, a group that it's tricky to try to define, who were in possession of all the science knowledge, invented this symbolic system as a way to pass that along as education to us in a way that we could preserve. The target of the education really wasn't the hunter-gatherers who lived at 9,000 BC. The target audience was really us. It was aimed at a society that would have enough knowledge of science to be able to recognize what they were talking about.
So do you think that, I mean, I know we've discussed this in the past, but who was the oldest, in your opinion, as far as cultures that, you know, I know you focus on the Dogon, where do you think that they were first to kind of have, you know, an amalgamation of all this knowledge? Or do you think that, you know, the Egyptians or further back, or like, what's your thoughts currently based on all the books and research that you've done?
Well, we're talking about a recurring cycle of time, comparable to the Yuga cycle, where the energetic shift, there's a cycle of energy that works like the seasons of the year. So just as we had spring a year ago, we're going to have spring again in a month or so. These cycles repeat themselves. So in our current half cycle of this cycle of humanity, it extends back to around 9,000 BC, you know, just after the end of the last ice age. And so the symbolism really dates back that far. You can find evidence of the tradition as far back as Göbekli Tepe in southeast Turkey at around 9,000 BC. It looks to me as if the Dogon have abiding connections to that tradition 11,000 years ago, and their culture preserves some elements that are directly linked to Göbekli Tepe. It looks to me as if the Dogon, who are a priestly tribe, did the best job of preserving that knowledge intact. And so they got enlisted around 3200 BC to act as sort of assistant professors for a second round of instruction that happened in the area of Orkney Island around 3200 BC, near the village of Scarabray, in the very north of Great Britain, a very remote spot, but very, very accessible because all the ocean currents would bring ocean vessels right by Orkney. Yeah. So the Dogon looked like the ones who did the best job of keeping the material straight, although the Buddhists did a very good job, the Hindus did a very good job, and some other traditions did a pretty good job of keeping things straight.
How old do you think the Dogon tribe is in terms of like what we would recognize, whether it be oral tradition or, you know, whatever?
Well, because their language includes some very ancient Turkish words, very ancient Egyptian words. Well, the Egyptian words go back to about 3000 BC, but the ancient Turkish words might go all the way back to 9000 BC. The Dogon themselves, you can point to aspects of their culture that go back to 9000 BC. But the symbolic tradition, if it's part of this recurring cycle, may repeat. It may well be that there were prior cycles of this energy that were where instruction in the same material was also given, because we see a lot of the same shapes in petroglyphs. There are signs that there may have been an earlier tradition that was sort of abrupted by the ice age, and that survivors of that tradition, my friend John Anthony West, felt that the Göbekli Tepe tradition was conducted by survivors of that previous cycle. So it goes back pretty far.
Yeah. When you look at symbolism, you know, these ancient cultures, have you ever found anything comparative in terms of the symbols themselves? I know, you know, you're looking at the way they're translated and the etymology and stuff like that, but have you ever found any actual symbols that are similar that cross over?
Yes, and symbolic elements that are representative of certain concepts that are common among the different traditions. If you go to Göbekli Tepe, if you're familiar with any of the symbolic elements there, okay, I interpret Göbekli Tepe to have been a sanctuary, and anciently the concept of a sanctuary is a place where non-material and material energies come together. That was the ancient definition of what a sanctuary was. Well, virtually every symbolic element that you see at Göbekli Tepe, there's a perspective from which it represents that same concept. It can be represented in different ways. There's the entwining of those two energies. If we talk scientifically, we're talking about magnetism and electricity. And when they entwine together, that creates electromagnetism. That entwining of energy is referred to as the concept of an embrace. And at Göbekli Tepe, one of the pillars prominently features two carved arms that sort of emerge from the sides of the pillar and extend down the sides of the pillar with hands at the end that reach around the end of the pillar like this. An ancient Egyptian word for pillar also means embrace.
Yeah, those hands have been around those are found around the Moai. Those are found right. around ancient Mesoamerican sites and their right, statues. Right. Yeah.
A very, so very common position for a figure to be standing in with their hands sort of at their belt together, fingertip to fingertip.
Yeah, that one's interesting to me because that's still, I mean, we can talk about like the ancient handbags or symbols or whatever, but the one with the arms around the navel, that's still one, I mean, did ancient people just stand around with their hands, you know, like together like that around their bellies or what?
Yeah, no, it was a symbolic reference, but trying to understand what the symbolism is. But there are any number of other elements there that represent the same thing. There's a carved image of a sort of parentheses figure with a circle at the center of it. And that's how the Dogon represent the concept of Sirius and the sun coming together. You remember in ancient cultures, the year very often began with what's called the heliacal rising of the sun. That's because of the way the motions of the stars are. There's a period of time where we can't see Sirius because it sits in the bright glare of our own sun. And so for a period of something like 72 days, we can't see Sirius. When it finally reemerges, it reemerges just before the rising sun. And that's called the heliacal rising. And it's a recurring event that happens with regularity. And so all the ancient cultures used it to mark the start of a calendar year. Well, that symbol, the parentheses with the dot, is symbolic of those two stars coming together, which are themselves symbolic of the two energies coming together. The Sirius is an icon for non-material energy, and the sun is an icon for material energy. You have another figure at Göbekli Tepe. It looks like the English letter H. And that symbol survived into the modern Masonic tradition. And there was an article around 1900 that came out in a magazine called the New Age Magazine. It's a Masonic magazine. And a long article explaining how that figure symbolizes the idea of non-material and material energy coming together to catalyze processes of creation. So that's true of element after element at Göbekli Tepe. They all represent the same concept. Well, I understand that one of the features of symbols or symbolic elements that are original to the ancient tradition is that they include an aspect of self-confirmation of their own meaning. So they didn't just say a thing one time. They said it 14 different ways, not knowing which of those metaphors was going to resonate with somebody like you and me. They hoped that, you know, one or more of them would metaphor only works if you get the reference. I can compare something you don't know to something you do know, but if, say, it's a character on a TV series you've never watched, you're not going to get the reference. So thousands of years ago, whoever put the system together had to figure out, now, what things can we compare things to that are going to make sense to somebody thousands of years from now?
What about... did the Dogon have any like mystery traditions or rituals? Like, I know a lot of the stuff, you know, we talk about ancient Egypt or Göbekli Tepe or whatever might have been connected to some sort of ritualistic or rites or something like that. Is that something that the Dogon have within their society or?
They do. A lot of the Dogon rituals are a close match for what you see in ancient Judaism. The Dogon wear skull caps like Jews do. They wear prayer shawls like Jews do. They celebrate a Jubilee year like Judaism does. So the Dogon have family lineages like Judaism does. Judaism has have the Levi and the Kohanes, and the Dogon have the equivalent of that. These are mythical heads of families within the Dogon culture, that, and those family groupings still exist. So there's a lot of overlap. Ritually, it's the connections are most obvious with Judaism, but there are many other rituals that tie to other traditions. For example, one of the whoever was teaching this system of cosmology was also trying to teach us civilizing skills, and their main goal was to help us transition from being hunters and gatherers to being farmers. So they were teaching us agriculture. And so one of the symbolic elements here that survives in many different cultures is the choice to situate ancient sites in view of a particular kind of mountain. Originally, it was a single mountain that was shaped like an elephant lying down. And if they positioned their little village in the right place so that they were sitting east of one of those mountains, then every day they could watch the sunset behind that mountain, and every day they could see the sun setting further and further south until you reach the solstice, and then further and further back north again until you reach the solstice again. So it gave them an agricultural calendar, a natural agricultural calendar that they could use to judge when to plant their seeds and when to harvest their crops and things like that. Well, by the era of Orkney Island, that tradition shifted, because at Orkney, you happen to have two mountains situated in a way so that the rising sun will and setting sun, sorry, the setting sun will do that. And so not only did you have the sun moving behind, seeming to move southward behind the mountains, but at the equinox, it set squarely between the mountains. So you could identify immediately when the equinox was. A few hundred years later, when ancient Egypt, dynastic Egypt, was becoming established, they founded a civic center called Abydos. Abydos, the Egyptian name for Abydos, was originally Abdu, and there's a commentator named Om Seti who tells us that Abdu originally meant the desired mountain. And so you go to Abydos today, and there's an ancient cemetery there where First Dynasty and Second Dynasty high officials of ancient Egypt were buried. And it's in direct view of two mountains with a gap like that, just like the one on Orkney. And you also have the equinox sunset falling squarely between the two mountains.
Yeah, and if anybody's interested, some of the previous episodes we've done with Laird, we've had like slides up and stuff talking about what he was talking about with the symbology or the symbolism at Göbekli Tepe and comparative stuff. And there was, I think one of them, I have to go back and watch, but I can't find the image anymore. But we were comparing, there's the fox from Göbekli Tepe looks exactly like the fox found on an altar from the Dogon tribe, which right. is pretty interesting.
Right. And that's that picture of the altar I was posting about it this week. It's an interesting photograph because right on it, it's labeled Getty Images. It's the property of Getty Images. But I can no longer find the image online anywhere. It's disappeared from
well,
any posts.
It's carved into one of our up. I'd have to go back. Like I said, we've done, you know, almost probably 10 episodes with you, probably some of them close to 2 hours, over 2 hours. So I'd have to go through and look for it. But in one of those episodes, we for sure have that on screen there. So
right. And I still have a copy of that image, but and a couple of additional copies that were taken by different photographers in different eras. But Getty Images denies that it's their image, and they won't link me up with the photographer who took the image, even though his name's also printed on it. So it's a very strange situation that, I mean, what's going on here that something they specifically claimed as being theirs, they no longer say they have as part of their...
Yeah, that's weird. Well, I mean, maybe they know, maybe they don't. Who knows? You know, it might be one of those things. But Let's talk about Waters of Life now. So in the previous, I think, few, last time we just talked about comparative cosmology and just general ancient metaphysics and stuff like that. I think the time before that we had you on, we talked about your previous book, Amma and the Universe. What is the Waters of Life about? Like, what's the general main point of the book, would you say?
Okay, I had said there were multiple themes, creational themes that are being dealt with by the Dogon, the structure of matter and the formation of biological life, and formation of consciousness are some of those. The Waters of Life is the first book where my primary focus shifts to the biological aspect of the symbolism, rather than primarily on the atomic, you know, the structure of matter aspect. But it's all the same dynamics of energy. If you understand it in one context, it'll help you understand it in another context. So Amma and the Spark of the Universe is primarily getting down to the very nitty-gritty of creational energy. We're talking about magnetism and electricity, and the Dogon approach is, in trying to educate us about this, is to find ways of expressing all of the root attributes of both of those energies. Here are the root dynamics of how they work, down to specific drawings that are scientifically correct about, you know, what does the unresisted flow of electricity look like, and what does the root state of magnetism look like? How is it that magnetism induces electricity to move? Normally, electricity tries to move in a straight line, but magnetism diverts it. And the Dogon have representations of all these things that are scientifically correct. And some of it starts to get so subtle that these days, in order to be able to demonstrate that it's really scientifically correct information, I'm having to turn to top physicists of the 1920s and 30s. I've spent the better part of the past couple of years reading many of the books that these physicists wrote that are aimed at a layperson's understanding of why the physics are what they are. You know, these are people who personally witnessed all of the theoretical developments in physics around Einstein and other colleagues of theirs. And they understood why it was that this development knocked that development out of the water, and why physicists used to think this, but now they think that. So it's in the context of those books that we start to get specific explanations for how and why these Dogon references make sense scientifically. So the Waters of Life is leaning more on that material to try to explain things, and starting to explain how is it that we have parallelism between how biological life comes about and how matter comes about. Because, as I said, it's the same set of dynamics that make both work. The Dogon say that the same dynamics of energy that cause life to come about also promote consciousness. So those energetics are a little bit like the seed for a weed. You know, if you drop a seed for a weed someplace, if the circumstances are right, you're going to get weeds growing. The same thing seems to be true with consciousness, that if those energetics are in the right situation, the right context, the right environment, that you're naturally going to get consciousness developing in different forms.
Yeah, that's interesting. And what? So you went back to these old books from the 1920s and these older physicists and things that they were saying. What have you talked to any newer physicists or anybody that's currently studying this stuff? And if so,
we really don't want to do that because there's misdirection that's been, or apparent misdirection that's been going on. I'll try to give you an example of a very clear example of the misdirection, deliberate misdirection. In 1927, a French physicist who was also an aristocrat, his name was Louis de Broglie. He was a colleague of Einstein's. In 1927, he published a paper where he had done the math and determined that in a hydrogen atom, you know, in a hydrogen atom, there's one electron and one proton. And that electron, depending on how much energy it has, can sit in a number of different stable orbits around the proton at different distances from the proton. De Broglie figured out that those stable orbits correspond to points of resonance for the energy mathematically. And so that meant that resonance was a key concept that needed to be considered when we're talking about how the energy of matter works. That paper was highly praised by Einstein at the time it was first published, and it became the foundation of Schrödinger's quantum theory. However, the paper got disappeared. It was never even translated into another language. It was only in French. And for almost a century, no one had a copy of it until in 2018, there's a physicist, a modern physicist from Quebec who I've been in contact with. His name is André Michaud. And he published a paper saying, look, folks, there's a very, very significant paper here that you don't know about. And he republished parts of it in French and parts of it in translation in English. I mean, he gave both the French and the English and said, look, this is the missing link that seems to tie quantum effects to Einstein's theory of relativity. This is a very important thing. Einstein once said that working from this model, you could pretty much explain anything.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that too, because I just read an article this last week that said scientists believe that they've got something fundamentally wrong about the understanding of our universe in relationship to like dark matter and like what Saul Perlmutter and that team kind of investigated, I think, in the 90s. So, do you think that? So, is your what you're saying is that you think that there are at least our understanding or modern day science's understanding is predicated on some false assumptions about things that we probably knew at one point at the turn of the century and then lost it, or?
Well, yeah, that in certain objective ways, modern scientists have been sent off chasing wild gooses here. For example, it was the outlook of de Broglie, of Einstein, and of Schrödinger that events that happen in the quantum domain, which we are not able to directly measure, are still causal. That, you know, in the macrocosm, when we look at events that happen with energy in the material domain, we can see that event A causes event B. Well, the very popular outlook on quantum physics is that somehow it's no longer causal, that it's now only probabilistic, and that when you get below a certain size, an electron in motion no longer has an objective location. It only has a probable location, and that all that matters are the formulas that calculate those probabilities, that the electron might theoretically be found in any position at all within its associated wave of energy. De Broglie's paper is the key that demonstrates that it remains causal. I compare the idea to, in child development, there's a concept called object permanency. The child has to learn at some point as it's maturing that every time mommy disappears, she doesn't cease to exist. If she goes out of view, she still exists. She's still doing the things that she does the way she always did them. And
Schrodinger's mom, right?
Yeah, Schrodinger's mom. That's right. So the same seems to be true about matter in the quantum domain, that all the energetics are still ultimately causal, but the entire world has been misdirected to think that it isn't, and they've been sent off to explore the probabilities of quantum physics without devoting a lot of attention to the causality of it.
I have a question here, actually, from a fellow author and researcher, Greg Little. He wants to know if you have any thoughts on the beginning, the Big Bang, maybe something that happened previous to that in regards to all your research and symbolism stuff.
Yeah, the Dogon tell us what the situation was prior to the Big Bang, just prior to the Big Bang. They describe two thorns that are essentially correlates to two black holes that held matter and energy in stasis between them two, the two of them. And that matter and energy spun quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker until it reached a point where the structures of the black holes could no longer contain it. And at that point, there was the equivalent of an explosion and what we see as the Big Bang. But some things you have to understand about the system is that in the Dogen conception, the primary factor that's changing with energy is the pace of time. I'll try to explain fairly quickly how that happens. This gets a little bit complicated. We're talking about a continuum of energy that moves between two states. The energies are magnetism and electricity. And if you think of bookends on this continuum of energy that the energy continually cycles back and forth through, one bookending state is a state where magnetism is dominant and electricity is dormant. That's called superinsulation. The other bookending state is called superconductivity. And in that state, the reverse is true. Magnetism is dormant and electrical flow is unrestricted. That at every level of the energetics, starting with electrical and magnetic dipoles, but in continuing up through atoms and molecules and all sorts of other things, energy is persistently cycling between those two states back and forth, and each one fosters the other one. So the Dogen give us a view of the dynamics of energy at every one of those levels, or at all of the main levels there. If we take the lowest dimensional view, we get a very simplified perspective on what the dynamics are between the component elements. For example, at the lowest dimensional view, there's only one candidate for what gravity is, and there's only one candidate for what causes the apparent expansion of space. When you get up to the higher dimensional levels, we get a lot more nuance about how those transactions happen. So the Dogen are basically saying to us, you don't need to be able to directly observe what happens on the quantum level because the energetics are parallel. If you observe what happens on a macrocosmic level, say what happens between astronomical bodies like the Sirius stars and the sun, you'll have an exact representation that you can infer from what has to happen on the quantum level. So math for the Dogen is a worthwhile tool, but it should not be our primary tool in trying to sort this stuff out, because math has some problems. Anytime you get into structures that are large enough or small enough, you either end up with concepts of infinity or you end up with division by zero, and math doesn't handle either of those things well. So if I were standing at the bottom of a hill next to a road that ran up the hill and over the top of the hill and seemed to disappear at a point at the top of the hill, if I use math to analyze that, I arrive at the concept of a singularity at the top of the hill. If I treat that problem as a problem of direction and distance, I learn what's over the top of the hill. The Dogen are trying to show us what's over the top of the hill of energy that we can't see. And the way you do that is with a qualitative view, not a quantitative one. Einstein's revelations all began as qualitative interpretations, not as mathematical ones. He used got mathematicians to verify what he inferred had to happen qualitatively.
Yeah, it's funny. You were talking about numbers and zero and stuff. My son, who's like super smart already, he's only like a little over two. He's putting together puzzles and stuff, and he's got all these like this number puzzle. And for some reason, every single time he grabs zero and just chucks it, he just throws it. It's almost like this doesn't exist. I'm just, you know, but I think I find that funny. I don't know why. I've asked him too. I'm like, why don't you like zero? You know,
he's right. The ancients do that too. When you're working with a like graph that's numbered, you know, sequentially 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you get to the center of the axis of the graph. They don't call that zero. They take that as the starting point to start counting again positively in a different direction. You've had a change of direction, you haven't had a change in the math. So now trying to get back to why time is the factor that's primarily changing. The traditional view of the material domain is that we live in a world with three linear dimensions and one dimension of time, which Einstein introduced. But when he introduced that, what he wasn't really cognizant of was he was introducing us to an ancient concept of what I term energetic dimensionality. And this is the idea that magnetism is defined based on two energetic poles, a north and a south pole. So magnetism relates to an energetic concept of a linear dimension, of a one-dimensional view. Electricity is founded on a single monopole, so that's the equivalent of a geometric concept of a geometric point. But prior to magnetism, there's another state. It's called instanton knots. Hinduism refers to it as a state of omkara, where three monopoles are theoretically defined. So you're moving from a domain of three monopoles to one of two monopoles to one of one monopole, which then evokes the linear dimensions, which go from a line defined by two points and an area defined by four points and a volume defined by eight points. And those two domains of dimensionality interface with each other. But you go back to the magnetism, and the magnetism, it can only sit in two potential ways. And in its sort of one-dimensional domain, you can have the North Pole conceptually up, or you can have it conceptually down. But that's the only way you can have it. So aligned one way, you get a state of superconductivity. Aligned the other way, you get a state of superinsulation. And so what's happening is, one at a time, these little tiny magnets are being flipped. And as they flip, they now sit anti-parallel to the rest of the domain they're in. There's parallel magnetism pulls together and anti-parallel magnetism pushes. And so as soon as you flip that magnet, it's now in a situation where it can no longer stay in the domain it's in. It's got to self-differentiate out into a second domain, and that becomes the material domain. Now, to understand what's happening with the pace of time, Einstein said that when you increase mass, which is ultimately a function of magnetism for the Dogen, you're also slowing the pace of time. Now, we have lots of indicators that since the time of the Big Bang, the pace of time has been progressively slowing down. One of the indicators of that is the further out we look into the universe, the quicker events happen, to the point where we're now looking at structures. The Webb telescope is pointing us to structures that are exceedingly old, billions and billions of years old, so old that the scientists are confused. How did this gigantic structure have time to have formed? Because based on our theories of how old the universe is, it shouldn't have had enough time. What they're not accounting for is the fact that the pace of time in that era ran a lot quicker than it does now. So a million years didn't take a million years. It took, say, 1,000 years. So those structures from the Dogen conception had plenty of time to form. We're sitting in a position where the pace of time has progressively slowed down. And so as we look out into space, we're looking through domains where time ran progressively quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. And so it looks to us that as the universe extends outward, it seems as if it's expanding at a quicker and quicker pace, but it isn't. What's really happening, according to the Dogen, is our pace of time has been progressively slowing down. So it's as if you were on a train track and there was a second train right next to your train, and one of the trains changes speed. It might not be immediately clear to you whether your train was the one that changed speed or whether the one next to you changed speed, because it's all relative. Same thing happens in the universe. Now, the way that works is, imagine that you were an objective observer and that you understood and could measure exactly how long, objectively, a moment of time took. And you know that light travels at a uniform speed. And so during that objective moment of time, you can calculate how far light ought to a beam of light ought to extend during that moment. Now imagine that while you were sleeping, someone slipped in unbeknownst to you and doubled the duration of that moment of time without you knowing it. Now, because light again travels at a consistent speed, that during that now doubled duration of a moment of time, light would be able to extend twice as far as it had before in a moment. And so it would look to you as if space was expanding because every factor you had to judge by and to measure by made it look like the light was now extending twice as far as it used to extend. And so now you measure a universe that's twice as big or seems to be twice as big as it was before. Simply by affecting the pace of time, you cause that effect to happen. And many of the other effects of physics are the direct consequence of the pace of time slowing down.
I have another question here somebody asked. Okay. And I got to grab a cable real quick off screen. So after I ask this, I'm going to hit this button for a second, but keep going. KK Schertzer asks, Laird, do you agree with the philosophy of science, PhD Philip Goff's arrival at panpsychism and cosmopsychism? I mean, it's, you know, do you believe that matter or molecules or subatomic particles have some level of consciousness?
The simple answer is yes. The ancient outlook is that the same energetics that produce matter also promote consciousness. So at very least, you have the potential for consciousness in the energetics that make an atom, a hydrogen atom, work. There's a perspective, I think Robert Temple, who wrote the first book on the Dogon, the book that popularized the Dogon as people, recently came out with a book where he's talking about plasma clouds that he says have attributes that we normally associate with living creatures and conscious creatures. And plasma, in the perspective of certain physicists, represents, you know, 99% of the universe is plasma, not matter. So I think it's entirely possible, because of the way the energetics work, that all up and down the scale, that each materialized form has at least a potential for consciousness, if not an actualized consciousness.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is something I've thought a lot about, too. Like, we just did an episode, part two, where I discussed my near-death experience, more of like the mystical, you know, my moment of grace, that kind of stuff. And part one was just the logistics of how it all happened. But we were talking about, we had a guest on a couple years ago, Rob Gentile, and he wrote this book called Quarks of Light. And he talks about how he got this, so this younger woman committed suicide, unfortunately, but she was an organ donor, and he got her heart. And after he got her heart, he had cravings for things that were her favorite, like candy or certain things like that, which he never had in his life before. So it's, and after he found that out after talking with like her family. So it's just like things like that. So there must be some inherent consciousness within maybe organs, maybe matter in general, which would make sense on some level, right?
I can offer you a bit of an explanation about how that works. Okay, there are biologists. There was a late biologist, Mei Wan Ho. There's also a University of Washington biologist, Gerald Pollack, and they talk about a concept called coherent water. As it turns out, in any body of water, we imagine that water is all the same, it's uniform, but in truth it's not. It's oscillating between two states. But the oscillation happens so quickly that until very recently we haven't been able to measure the oscillation and know that it exists there. Basically, it's moving from a chaotic state, the molecules are moving from a chaotic state into a coherent state, and the coherent state is a form of a liquid crystal, that the molecules are aligned in certain ways that promote according to the Dogen, promote conductivity. If you can align all the molecules the same way, you also align the magnetism the same way and the electricity the same way, and you end up creating a state that is effectively superconductive. Now, it turns out that in any living creature, just inside the aqueous membranes of the creature, there are zones of coherent water that form that are called, the biologists refer to them as exclusion zones, because they tend to push all sorts of biological components away from the membrane. But those zones are filled with coherent water that is effectively superconductive. And they've done measurements of energetic signals that are conducted through the conduits of these little channels of water that sit next to the membranes, and they reach the brain half a second quicker than through the regular nervous system of a creature. They explain why creatures like hydras that have no nervous system can still function, because there's a second method of transmitting signals within a living creature. So it looks to me like it's possible that with a transplanted organ, that through those kinds of channels, that you might be getting communication of information to and from the sensibilities of the broader organism.
So is this what your book, The Waters of Life, is kind of about, in the sense like cymatics or like the...
Yes, it's...
Yeah, go ahead.
The term is really not applied to it. Okay, the idea, if we go back to the superconductive domain is sort of a byproduct of the instanton knots. And in a superconductive domain, you have an unrestricted flow of electricity that sits just below the threshold that would be necessary to evoke magnetism. Now, in that domain, every so often there are random sparks that occur, or many outside influences that interact with that domain disrupt the circuit of electricity and evoke a spark. And when you evoke a spark, you raise the level of the electricity above that threshold, and now you evoke two magnetic monopoles. And the three of those together constitute a proton-electron pair, that you have two magnetic poles, which is the effective equivalent of a proton, and you have one electric monopole, which is the equivalent of electron. And there's a dimensional separation between those monopoles. We know there is, because the electricities express themselves perpendicularly to each other, which is a signature of dimensionality. So this is what I call energetic dimensionality being expressed. And those three monopoles end up forming what the Dogen considered to be the fundamental building block of energy. As the monopoles of magnetism are evoked along with the electric monopole, the input of energy causes the magnetism to rotate, which is what sets that triad of monopoles anti-parallel to the domain and causes it to be pushed away from the domain, the same way at the membranes within a living organism, the molecules get pushed out also. What's happening in the biological creature is that infrared light is penetrating the membrane. And it's been shown now that infrared light in the right frequencies has the ability to effectively deconstruct a water molecule. So this happens with aqueous membranes. It doesn't happen with non-aqueous membranes. They're called hydrophilic or hydrophobic membranes. So in the hydrophilic membranes, the light passing through the membrane deconstructs the water molecule and causes them to rotate, so they're now sitting anti-parallel to the magnetism of the membrane. And those components then get shoved out into this domain of coherent water, where they reconfigure themselves in a superconductive way and now create these channels that communicate back and forth. The Dogen have a name for the monopoles and see them as messengers. They basically, their role is essentially to conduct messages between domains of energy, which Hinduism treats as domains of consciousness.
So who or what is behind all this? Are these just natural processes in the universe? And if that's the case, what does that mean? Like, is there, are we talking gods? Are we talking aliens? Are we talking metaphysical beings of some sort? Like, what's going on here?
Okay, the first thing to understand is that consciousness is a byproduct of magnetism and electricity, and magnetism and electricity are manifested forms, not primordial forms. So Rene Guenon, who is sort of the go-to guy for Hindu symbolism and metaphysics, says that consciousness, it can only be considered a manifested form. You can, there's no sensible outlook from which consciousness can be primordial. So that knocks out of the water the popularized concept of God being consciousness. Because if you associate God with the primordial potentials, you don't have consciousness to work with until you've already manifested the energy, and that's already beyond the role of potentials. So there are levels of consciousness or levels of energy that form all the way along the scale. We have visibility on those. If you look at the electromagnetic scale, the way that scientists represent the electromagnetic scale is it runs from gamma rays that were characteristic of the Big Bang era and are very short wavelength energies to very long wavelength energies like microwaves that we work with today. As a matter of fact, we scientists perceive the gamma rays of the Big Bang as microwaves. The wavelength of the light has extended outward. And when they say that, they have just confirmed the idea that the pace of time is slowing down because the pace of time is associated with those wavelengths of light, which are associated with the formation of mass. Another example that the Dogen perspective is a correct one is that during the same period of time in which the amount of mass in the universe doubled, the size of the universe also doubled. There's a one-to-one relationship between the formation of mass and what we perceive as the size of the universe. So there are lots of little indicators here that confirm the Dogen perspective is a correct perspective. The Dogen say that along this continuum of energy that runs from superconductivity to superinsulation at the level of universes, actually on all levels, that energy self-defines 14 domains the same way that if you go to the deepest part of the ocean, the deep seawater self-differentiates into biological zones, so that you have different kinds of life living at the surface than you do on the bottom of the ocean. Some of those biological forms are capable of moving between zones, like dolphins and whales. Other biological forms have to stay in the zone they live in. They can't move out of the zone they're in. And so our form of life in the material domain we live in is like one of those forms of life that can't move out of its zone. But the idea is there may be other forms of life that begin as energetic consciousnesses that are capable of moving between zones. And in fact, that's what the Dogen say happened with their symbolic tradition, that at the middle of the energetic cycle, it becomes possible to move between domains. The way to understand that is imagine that you're in a submarine and you go very deep into the ocean. It's at that point, it's not safe for you to try to step out into the ocean water because of the difference in pressure. But if you instead step into an airlock and equalize the pressure, then you can move perfectly safely out into the water. Same thing with a spaceship. The difference in pressure between the interior of the spacecraft and outer space would kill you if you try to just open the hatch. But if you step into an airlock and equalize the pressures, now it becomes possible to move between the domains. The Dogen are saying that at the midpoint of our domain, which in the current Yuga cycle, that would be approximately 3600 BC, that at that point in the cycle, the time frames of the two domains equalized, that there was an equivalent amount of mass in both domains, and so their time frames equalized. And at that point, it became possible for living entities that were originally non-material to step across into a material domain.
Interesting. Yeah, I know that's one of your main points of research is this idea of the material and the non-material and how they kind of interact. When you keep talking about like the pace of time, is that, have you ever, do you know what the pace of you is? Like why you or?
Well, that the term you refers to that same cycle. The reason it does is because, okay, let's go back to de Broglie. De Broglie documented two oscillations of energy in this hydrogen atom that where the orbits are defined by resonance. One oscillation happens at almost the speed of light. It's 99.9% of the speed of light, and it's the oscillation between the two magnetic poles of the proton. We can't measure it, so from our perspective, it's theoretical. It's not, it's probabilistic. It's not real. The other oscillation arises, okay, both of these oscillations arise from the what he calls the cyclical influence of magnetism. The first is on the two components of the proton. The second is on the orbiting electron. The oscillation that relates to the electron, he diagrammed both of them. He graphed them. And the graph that goes with the electron is the shape of an almond shape. The Dogen refer to that as the U seed, YU.
Yeah, the only reason why I brought that up is
that's the oscillation that has reality to it. De Broglie is saying that every particle in motion has two waves associated with it that arise from those two oscillations. And one of them we can't measure, and so it's probabilistic. And the other one we can directly measure. It happens at about 2% of the speed of light. And so that has reality to it, and it's the phase of those waves that correspond to the position of the particle as it moves along. But more important than all of that is that anytime you have two waves of energy that are perpetually moving into and out of phase with each other, because magnetism in motion evokes electricity and vice versa, so the electromagnetic waves are moving into and out of phase with each other. Anytime you have that, you create what are called beat frequencies. And you know what a beat frequency is because if you've ever been in your car on a highway and you've rolled down just one window, you hear a waka 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 sound, and that's a beat frequency. Those beat frequencies are why they occur not just in a hydrogen atom or in any atom. They also occur in electromagnetism in general. Einstein demonstrated that if you have electromagnetism just loose in the universe, it creates these beat frequencies. And those beat frequencies are what cause wave-like energy to also have a particle-like nature, because it's self-dividing into the beat frequencies, which is the same thing as conceptually as the domains of consciousness and domains of energy that Hinduism talks about. That those energetics naturally self-differentiate into units. So you're talking about the U seed, you're talking about the concept of the U, and the U,
yeah, was,
well, U as in U Ga. U for the Dogen means, refers to that seed shape, and Ga refers to the concept of temporality or time.
Well, I was bringing it up because of I was reading a book on Tao mysticism, and it was talking about, I think it was the first, who was it? Here, I'll pull this thing up real quick, what it says. I don't know. This is basic, but I think this is from Wiki. The story of Emperor Yu, the legendary founder of China's first dynasty, centers on his ability to drain floodwaters from lowland areas. So it's like connected to, it's like a dance. The paces of Yu is this dance of this like mystical dance that, I mean, I at least this is what I got from it. I could be wrong if somebody has any information, but I just thought it was interesting because it has to do with water. We're talking about water. You're also talking about yuga cycles and Yu. I just didn't know if there was any connection there.
Yeah, there's a direct connection. There's also a direct connection to that Chinese tradition, to the point that certain Chinese hieroglyphic words in their original form were formulated in the same way that corresponding ancient Egyptian word was. I have words with the same meaning that represent the same societal concept that's practiced the same way in both cultures, that are pronounced the same way and written with comparable glyphs. So we have direct comparability between the two hieroglyphic languages at around probably 3000 BC.
Yeah, there's not a lot known, right? I mean, the pyramids, I mean, what do they call it? China's Great Pyramid. It's like basically like covered up, or they let it grow, you know, the foliage grow over it and stuff like that. Right. We don't really know, right? I mean, other than like, you know, Buddhism and stuff about Tibet and stuff, we don't really have.
Right. They, and the part of the problem there is that events that happened around 3000 BC in China didn't get written down till around 300 BC. So you have endless infighting among the academics as to what did this mean. But there are certain points of comparison that are direct. For example, there was a plan for agriculture in ancient China that some researchers believe was only theoretical, that it was never actually implemented. But it's a direct match for the way Dogen conduct agriculture. They're both called the Wellfield Plan. And the symbolism actually is biological. It's not, it doesn't relate to matter. The way that Dogen cultivate their fields and the way they water them and the way they arrange them, it's all has biological symbolism to it. The configuration of the basic unit of land that Dogen cultivate, Meiwan Ho describes as the most efficient way for a cell to distribute water within itself.
So when we're talking about the waters of life, do you believe that water in combination with energy is the spark, is the source of what
That's
we know?
That's not quite it. The outlook of the Dogen is that water provides us with an explicit pattern for what energy does, that it does all the same things. For example, I was talking about instanton knots. Stephen Hawking says that they evaporate from black holes. So we start with a cycle that starts with evaporation. The monopoles of matter that theoretically emerge from the instanton knots are said to condense the same way raindrops condense out of a cloud. Not only that, the dynamics by which they condense are the same as the dynamics that raindrops form with. So we have a cycle of energy that is objectively the same as the cycle of water, and we understand the cycle of water. We can use it as a pattern to understand what's going on with energy. Now, we think of the cycle of energy as being a perpetual cycle. There's no start or end to it. But if we give a little thought to that, we realize there was a start to the cycle, that you couldn't have a cycle of water until you had water molecules form. So the starting point for the cycle of energy is the combining of three elements, the oxygen atom with the two hydrogen atoms, just as the start of the cycle of energy for the Dogen is the condensation of the three monopoles, two magnetic and one electrical. This is literally water.
Right.
These are water dynamics all the way up the scale.
So my question to you is, I know you're doing all this cross-referencing, you're looking at the symbols. Do you believe what they're saying? Like, I know you're saying that you're just taking them at their word, but you personally, as a person who has their own, I'm sure, ideas, theories, hypotheses, I know you're writing on this topic, but do you believe that they got it right? Or do you believe that this is correct in some sort of...
Yeah, they were working from express knowledge of how things work. This wasn't theory. They were telling us how the processes work. And their approach to telling us this was essentially to reduce fractions all the way along. They're trying to provide us with the simplest example of a thing or the simplest component aspect of a thing as building blocks for us to put the pieces together and sort out. Now, how does the big picture work? Because we now understand how it works at the level of an atom. How does it work if you go higher than the level of an atom? How does it go if you... it's even to the point where all of the dynamics of the way stars form, according to George Gamow, he describes those dynamics, and they're the same as the dynamics the Dogen are describing for how energy manifests. That, according to the Dogen, our sun emerged from a structure called Barnard's Loop in the company of the Sirius stars in the same way those three monopoles that are the electron-proton pair, by the same dynamics, they emerged together from Barnard's loop. And then our sun was ejected by the Sirius stars in the same way that the electrons ejected from the proton, even down to the drawing the Dogon make to show how it was ejected is a scientifically correct dynamic of how both how the electrons ejected and how a third star is typically ejected from a binary star system. The Dogon got all this stuff exactly right. This isn't, from my point of view, this isn't subject to question. It's not, could they be right? It's so consistently right, they could hardly be wrong.
Can you give us a little bit of a background on what led you specifically to the, I think we talked about this a long time ago. I think you saw something in a book or something, but like how did you get to the Dogon and how did you start to make these connections and kind of like unravel all this stuff?
Okay. I can thank my wife for that. She had read a book called Unexplained by Jerome Clark, where every chapter in the book was about some abiding mystery in the world that hadn't been solved yet. And one of the chapters was about the Dogon tribe and how was it that they seemed to know some things about the Sirius stars that they shouldn't reasonably know without access to telescopes or technology. And so I started looking into that. I thought, wow, wherever this leads is going to be interesting. And so I started making it my mission to educate myself about the concepts as we went. I had had some basic background in science. I was very fortunate in my educational upbringing. I grew up in Salem, Oregon. And their solution as a city to the problem of what do you do with the child in an elementary school classroom who might be bored in class? Their solution to that problem was to hire a team of teachers who were cross-qualified in different scientific disciplines. And not just scientific disciplines, but educational disciplines in general. They hired them as a team, as a shared resource for the city, and they would farm them out. They would assign each one to one of the elementary schools, and every day they would come into the elementary school and pluck 10 students out of the fourth, fifth, and sixth grades, take them into the library of the school, and sit us down and teach us whatever we wanted to learn. And so we were taught microscopy and chemistry and biology and psychology and marine biology and coding and how to use reference books and every conceivable discipline you can imagine. Every time we'd finish up one of the units, they would explain to us what the other units were and let us pick which one we wanted to learn next. It was an ungraded class, but we had periodic tests. But the way the tests work was, we'd all take the test together, and then as soon as the test was done, we would then grade the test. We'd trade papers with somebody, and we'd grade the test. But it was a situation where you were allowed to argue minority perspectives on the answer to a question. If you answered it one way, thinking the question meant one thing, you could then throw it up to the group to say, do we accept this as a correct answer or don't we? And the outcome was like playing a game of old maid, that whoever got the best score on the test, it was like a feather in their cap. And whoever got the worst score, it was like ending up with the old maid in the game of old maid. It was not entirely non-judgmental. In addition to that, every Monday, the class began with a brain teaser that was put on the blackboard. And the rule was the class didn't start until somebody solved the brain teaser, and you could use any resource of the library. You could confer with each other and work together, or you could work separately. It didn't matter. The rule was somebody had to solve that brain teaser before class started. And so it was a huge, hugely beneficial class. The two principles they taught me that were of most benefit to me, I really haven't gone beyond in my study of the Dogon. I haven't had to go beyond what I learned in those classes. Einstein said, if you can't explain a concept in terms that a six-year-old would understand, you don't understand it. But the two principles that
Feynman said something similar to, I bet he probably ganked that from him.
Yeah. The two principles that have been most beneficial to me are, the first is the concept of coincidence, that My teachers taught that at the point where you bump into what looks like the third coincidence, it's time to consider that something beyond coincidence is at work. That a coincidence is something that happens one in a thousand times. So if you have two coincidences, you're dealing with a situation that should only happen one in a million times. If you get to the third coincidence, you're up to one in 10 million times. This is no longer a credible coincidence. The second principle is that it's the job of a researcher to sincerely entertain all of the perspectives that are competing when you're trying to solve a problem. And what that means is essentially the same thing as if, let's say you were trying to show me a shortcut to work that would save me 10 minutes every direction, each direction when I went to and from work. My job is to let you do that. My job is to follow along where you try to lead me. Now, if that means you take me down a street that I was convinced was a dead-end street, it's not my job as a skeptic to say, oh no, you can't go down this street, that's a dead end. My job is to let you demonstrate to me how it's not a dead end.
Yeah, I got that portal. I got that portal waiting for us, you know?
Yeah. Now, at any time in the process when I bump into a possible objection, I was trained not to dismiss the point of view because of the objection. I was trained to ask myself, what would have to change in my own preconceptions to overcome that objection? And then continue forward on that basis. In other words, presume that what I think is true has got to be wrong, allow that it might be wrong, and see where that leads us. And so that's what I've done with the Dogen material, is every time I bump up against something that goes against the conventional wisdom, I ask myself, well, what else could we change here that would allow the Dogen's perspective to be the right one? For example, when they started talking about atoms and the components, they talked about protons and electrons. They didn't talk about neutrons. I thought, but I was taught atoms are made up of protons, electrons, and neutrons. How can they possibly be right about this? Well, eventually I came around to the point of view, which is the modern perspective, which is that a neutron is just the lowest resonant state of the electron and the proton. This is not a separate thing, that if you watch a proton long enough, it's transitioning from a proton to a neutron and back all the time. So the Dogen had it right. I didn't. That's happened on a number of occasions. One of the occasions, okay, there's a concept in ancient Egypt called Maat. It's a very complicated concept of truth or justice. Researchers of Egyptian language and culture have not really been able to adequately explain what Maat refers to. It was the job of the pharaoh to support Maat. It turns out that every ancient word prior to around 500 BC self-defines its own meaning. Confucius in China at 500 BC was loudly complaining because he could no longer count on ancient Chinese words to do that. The Dogen words do it because every Dogen syllable is a conceptual building block. Every syllable relates to a concept. And when you take a spoken Dogen word that's more complicated than one syllable, if you substitute the syllables for, or the concepts for the syllables, the word explains to its own meaning, the original intended meaning of the word. The Egyptian hieroglyphs do the same thing. Every glyph associates with a concept. If you substitute concepts for glyphs, you produce a symbolic sentence that explains to you what the intended meaning of the word was. So there's an Egyptian word for mat, and I can tell from the symbols that it's written word what the symbols say. The sentence that's produced by the syllable, the symbols, is perception is the foundation of perception is the foundation of material measure, is what it says. It's a caution. It says how you perceive a thing determines what it looks like to you. So if you don't allow for the possibility that you think that certain things you think are constant, like distance and time, if you don't allow for the fact that these might be variable measures, not fixed measures, you're going to come up with the wrong answer. That's why a cubit is a variable measure. It's measured by the distance two ways. It can be measured as the distance between a person's elbow and the tip of their finger, which is different on every person. Or you can measure it as the average pace or step of a person, which also varies by person. It's because the things they were measuring with the cubits, their meanings don't depend on the actual size you measure. They depend on the relationship between the things you measure. So it doesn't matter what size you measure it at.
Very interesting. Yeah, I think who did we have on where we were talking? Donald Carroll, and I think he was talking about his book, Cubit of Light, where he's talking about kind of what you're talking about, the ancient cubit and how it applies to all the ancient megalithic sites and stuff like that. Is there something, you know, now that you've done all this research, it doesn't even have to be Dogon related, but is there something that you find just like a massive ancient mystery still to this day? I mean, obviously we could probably look to the pyramids and all that, but is there something specific that you are curious about that maybe there's not a lot of information on?
Well, there's one mystery that the Dogon don't try to explain. As we go through this process, as we're tracing material forms from a domain of pure energy to a domain of atoms and beyond, there's only one stage of that whole process that they haven't specifically defined with examples and with words and so on. And that is the action that is carried out by what anthropologists see as their god, Amma. But you can tell based on Amma's attributes and Amma's name and a bunch of other things that Amma is a personification of the concept of magnetism. The pivotal act that Amma is credited with is that at the time those monopoles condense from the instanton knots, Amma is the one who pulls together the two magnetic poles. And they don't explain to us how it is that Amma accomplishes that. I can see that it ultimately has to rest on the concept of resonance. I don't have a grasp yet on what aspect of resonance allows the two magnetic poles to pull together and to push apart. I don't have all the details of that spelled out yet, but to be fair, when I started Amma and the Spark of the Universe, I spent weeks and weeks trying to sort out what happened at the domain, at the boundary between energy and matter. I had to sort that out for myself. And the way I did it was by understanding that there's parallelism in the energetics, I explored what happens at the surface of water, which is the boundary between a domain of water and a domain of air. This gets into another concept that's very important. That's important to understand if you can understand the dynamics. In the Dogon perspective, this slowing pace of time in the universe creates differences between, you know, if you're at point A or point B and there's a difference in the pace of time, you have an effect. That effect is gravity. That progressive changes in the pace of time are to gravity what progressive changes in water pressure are to buoyancy. It works exactly the same way. Gravity is a push, it's not a pull. And so the difference in time frame, an object of mass gravitates naturally to the domain of slowest time frame. A buoyant object gravitates naturally to the domain of least water pressure. Exactly parallel processes. And so if you think of time as being the fabric of the universe, then Einstein's right. We're bending and warping the fabric of time. But it's not exactly as Einstein conceptualizes it. This is not a bed sheet that's being warped. I never really understood how warping a bed sheet could cause the Earth to exert a pull on a satellite. I understand how it could cause a satellite in motion to move around the Earth, but what causes the pull down towards the Earth? That didn't seem intuitive to me. Buoyancy explains it.
So how did they, or how do you think that they figured this stuff out? Like, in terms of, were they doing thought experiments? Were they altering states?
Now, they're claiming direct instruction from beings who were originally non-material.
Yeah, so like, so does that mean that that's when that point was the two, the immaterial and the material, were closest together? And if so, when are we supposedly going to be at that point again?
Well, we're at the bottom of the
half cycle. We need to be there soon. We need to be there tomorrow.
We're at the bottom of the half cycle right now. We're starting back
and it
up
feels like that, right? Doesn't it feel like
we're at the energizing side. We're becoming less material right now, and we're past the point where we're the most material. Now, you remember at the same stage half a cycle ago, Atlantis, which had always been considered by the Greeks to be the most moral of cultures, was suddenly involving itself in hugely amoral actions. That the Greeks were the one who had to oppose Atlantis and stop them from conquering the Mediterranean. So that's the same kind of effect we're seeing in terms of morality in the modern day, that we've seen a huge shift in the overall morality of society and the outlook on what constitutes moral actions.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about this a lot, but in Plato's dialogues, he has Socrates, I think, mentioned a couple times that when humans don't have a higher power or a higher calling than themselves to look to, things become chaotic and immoral and things like that. And that's, I feel like if you look at society now, because of people abandoning religions and traditions and becoming more isolated and not community driven, if you will, it seems like we are in this weird phase because of technology where we've kind of isolated ourselves, and that, you know, that's why you have people looking towards UFOs and aliens. It's almost like we're looking for that next thing, right? Or something along those lines.
Right. Now, in the traditions I study, these are very often expressly non-theistic. This all rests on a philosophy called Samkhya in India, which is the foundation for most of the classic esoteric traditions in India. It's also a companion to yoga. Yoga is the personalized expression. Samkhya is the cosmological expression. But Samkhya is expressly non-theistic. It was originally presented as objective science. And so the outlook isn't that religion is what is the source of morality. The outlook is morality is prerequisite to the choice to live around other people. Imagine if you and I had been living separately in the world, we're the only two people on the planet, and we decided that we wanted to live in proximity to each other. That's not possible unless we both have confidence the other person's not going to kill us in our sleep. Morality is prerequisite.
Which we can't guarantee that right now.
Right, but it's prerequisite to the choice to associate with other people. If I can't count on you not to steal my things while I'm sleeping, we don't have a basis to be around each other. So the Dogon have civic practices in place to preserve the peaceful and moral nature of their own society. The first structure built in a Dogon village is called a toguna. It's a meeting house. And the rule in Dogon society is anytime a dispute arises between two or more people, all parties to the dispute are required to go to this meeting house, which is built to half height, so you have to sit down while you're there. You can't stand up. And none of them are allowed to leave until they've solved the problem to everybody's satisfaction. And so consequently, disputes don't arise in Dogon culture very often because they know that that's what they're going to have to go do. They're going to have to go resolve it.
They got to go to the house.
Yeah.
Figure it out.
Right.
Greg asks, what we're talking about, the immaterial beings giving them instruction. He wants to know, could they have been hallucinogenic or possibly the result of altered states or entheogens or something along those lines? Like, Not to say that that wasn't real, but just that maybe that's the way that it's...
Samkhya says, okay, in the fully energetic state, the fully non-material state, the non-material universe has perfect knowledge and an inability to take action. It's the equivalent of REM sleep for us. In a fully materialized state, we have imperfect knowledge, but full ability to take action. So Samkhya says that there are routine attempts made from the non-material side to communicate knowledge to the material side and to induce actions on the material side. And those attempts take the form of meaningful synchronicities, understanding that coincidences are still a thing. Not every synchronicity is, not every coincidence is a synchronicity. Vivid dreams, the unusual action of animals, clairvoyance, paranormal things like telepathy, and pretty much any effect that we consider to be paranormal falls in that category. That all of these things are, the hallucinogenic drugs also is a way of doing it. There, I think Kabbalism defines a dozen different classes of what they call mystics, who are classified based on how they access that kind of information. I fall in a class that they call a pure mystic. A pure mystic is somebody who has cosmological knowledge made available to them as they need it. I'll give you an objective example of how that happens. When I was early in my process, I was looking for a particular book. I was following a bibliography, and one of the books I was sure I needed was called Ancient Near Eastern Texts Relating to the Old Testament. This is a 700-page book, and this was back in the late 1990s before you could go online and order out-of-print books. So I had exhausted every source I had to acquire the book. I'd even gone to the Vassar College Interlibrary Loan Service to see if they could get the book, and they couldn't. So I finally had to concede to my wife that I wasn't going to be able to get that book I was looking for. And so now, a couple of days later, a box turned up at our back doorstep. And in the box had been sent to us by an aging cousin she had who lived in a little apartment in Queens, New York. And every so often, he would reach critical mass in the apartment, and he would toss a bunch of random crap into a box and mail it off to a relative. And in that box was my book, of all things. He had no idea I was even interested in the subject. He couldn't even remember having owned the book. So years later, I'm exploring an Egyptian goddess. Her name is Meshkenet, and she's one of the goddesses of birth, but she also has responsibility for death. And I was trying to learn more about how does this come about, that these two transitions are under the domain of a single goddess. I couldn't find in all of the material I had any clear descriptions or definition of who Meshkenet was, except in that 700-page volume. And what the text in that volume had to say about Meshkenet was that one of her roles in mythology was to make sure that writers had what they needed. I thought that's pretty interesting, that the book that comes to me out of desperation because I couldn't get what I needed is the one that tells me that that's what her role was.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, that's a real synchronicity if I've ever heard one.
Yeah. So anyway, I should probably wrap this up pretty soon.
Yeah, let's wrap it up. I was just going to say that, actually.
But the outlook basically is there's only one factor relating to energy that changes as we move from non-materiality to materiality, and that's the pace of time. And that's a factor that modern science is not even considering. But there are lots and lots of indications that that's what's true and that's what's happening. When you consider that one factor, now all sorts of other issues evaporate, which is another principle I was taught in my class in elementary school, is that as you entertain each of these comparative approaches to solving a problem, you know you hit the right answer because one of its attributes is, one of its effects is, that all of the seemingly intractable obstacles evaporate. They disappear. They're no longer concerns anymore. It simplifies everything. It reduces fractions.
So what do you have a new book you mentioned possibly in the works, and like, when can we expect that? Do you think, is it still a ways out or is it close?
Well, I'm right now doing a final read through before I turn it over to my wife to edit it. She's the person you want to have edit books. I'm going to self-publish this volume. I've learned over time that for a lot of reasons it works better for me to self-publish than to traditionally publish. My first probably 10 or so books were traditionally published through a subsidiary of Simon & Schuster called Inner Traditions. And they did a terrific job, a very talented staff and team, very good art staff to develop book covers, very good team to promote the books.
I love Inner Traditions.
But it reached a point where it was just taking too long to get the books published. So I was discovering I had time to self-publish a second book the same year that they published a book. 4 years in a row, I did that. I self-published one book and traditionally published a second book. And now I pretty much just self-publish.
Yeah, now you have 14 books. I mean,
yeah, the new book is called The Third Eye, and the focus of the book is on these energetics that create the beat frequencies and how those energetics are represented in a bunch of the ancient cultures and what the ultimate implications of those energetics are. How do you tie a proton-electron pair to those energetics? And how do you demonstrate those same energetics at work at the level of the proton-electron pair? Because the Dogons say the dynamics of the energies don't change from level to level.
Well, I'll, of course, check that out. And it's always a pleasure having you on. We've obviously had you on a ton in the past, and it's always an interesting conversation, whether we're talking about ancient Egypt or Göbekli Tepe or the Dogon or whatever. It's always a fascinating conversation. You obviously do your research. You know a lot about these cultures, and it's always a pleasure having you on. And
thank you. I appreciate coming on.
Yeah, and, you know, what do we know, right? What do we know about the unit? Like I said, there's always a new article coming out every week. We discovered this, and then the next week it's like, oh, you know, they fundamentally have something wrong about their understanding of the universe, you know? So it's like it keeps flip-flopping, right? Same thing with consciousness. Well, so
I'd say probably the most astounding thing to me in the whole process is to discover I had the ability to read people like René Guénon or Louis de Broglie critically. In other words, as I was reading the things they had written, I was aware, based on the ancient perspectives, which aspects of it they likely had wrong, and then I could go research those.
Well, there you go. I mean, we got to keep pushing this boulder up the mountain, right? We got to keep going. But like I said, I really appreciate your time. Go check out Lair's books. I have the link down below to all of his books on Amazon. Really great reads. If you haven't, go check them out. The Mystery of Scarabray, one of my favorites. Is it Knowledge or which one? I've got like 10 of your books on my thing. Let me pull it up real quick. There's one of them that I really,
Primal Wisdom of the Ancients.
That's the one. I don't know. That one resonated with me a lot.
There's another book that's sort of off topic that I always wanted to write. It was called The Velikovsky Heresies, and it reexamines Immanuel Velikovsky's very controversial Venus theory in light of 60 years of science that had been conducted since he published.
I know that's a so are you going to write it or what?
No, I wrote it.
I'm joking.
I published back in 2000.
That is your only book that has nothing to do with.
Right, and actually indirectly it does have things to do with what I'm writing about, but it was a topic that was close to my heart and I wanted to write it. I asked the publisher if they'd be interested in publishing a book on that subject, and they said, you know, we've been thinking for quite a while about publishing a book by Velikovsky. We didn't have a manuscript to publish.
So, that's one of your more popular ones too. I see, you know, when people are either interviewing you or promoting your work or whatever, it's always Velikovsky, which makes sense. I mean, people love alternative stuff and different, you know, points of views on the way things work or how things came to be and things like that. So that one,
I've actually become friendly with his grandson, who is a psychiatrist in Princeton, New Jersey, because of the book. He had been looking for videos of his grandfather's lectures and came across my book instead and bought a copy and then called me because he liked it so much.
So. Yeah, like I said, I mean, I whenever I type in to see, you know, like I pulled up The Waters of Life today on online, whenever I type in Laird Scranton, the very almost every single time the next word's Velikovsky after that. So
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for the chat. I'm sorry I have to go here.
No, you're good. Sorry to keep you a little bit longer than anticipated. But look, I really appreciate your time. You're an amazing author. Keep doing what you're doing. We look forward to your next one. If anybody wants to support Laird, again, go check out the books. Links down there at the bottom. He's done a ton of other podcasts, including our show. I think we've done like between 8 and 10 episodes with him and a bunch of Patreon segments. So go check that out. If you want to support Mindscape, click the Linktree link down below. He's also got a little part in our documentary, As Within, So Without, from UFOs to DMT. Go check that out. The link's down below as well. And yeah, we will catch you next time, everybody. We love you. Stay safe out there. And see you all next time. Peace.
Thank you very much.